I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high and canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man, I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man, I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man, I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota.
Good evening, Vashon Island. I am Megan Hastings, and this is the Cats and Jammer Follies, a travel show. And today we have with us a recurring guest, and his name is Dan Chasen. He's somebody who likes to travel around this globe and talk to us about it. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
How are you?
Better.
Good, I'm glad.
I've had the plague like so many others.
Yeah. Oh, God. Vashon just got beaten down. I can't even believe how many people have had it.
I know.
It's been crazy. But on to happier things, because we don't want to dwell on COVID. It's been too many years that we've talked about it now. I'm ready for it to just go away permanently. And as the world opens up and everybody's back to travel, I just came back actually last night from San Francisco. Airport was packed. Flight was packed. It was crazy town, and felt great. Have you been traveling, Dan?
I haven't been traveling at all. I mean, for me, traveling is leaving the island, you know.
Well, you do have some archival stories in you, so I'm ready to hear them.
Okay.
You want to tell us a little bit about it, about one of them first?
Yeah, this is something I've actually talked about before on your show, I think. It's a trip that Barbara and I took many, many years ago when we were first married, and took us around a good deal of the world, and just became, you know, sort of a bedrock thing in our lives.
And that was when you were writing for The New Yorker, correct?
Yes.
That's a good gig, taking you around the world writing for The New Yorker. I'm going to come back and do that.
Why not?
So where do you go in this first story?
Well, it starts, I mean, it actually talks about two different trips, both starting from the Brooklyn waterfront. There were still commercial piers in Brooklyn in those days. And
that's where you're from, correct?
I'm not from Brooklyn originally,
but New York.
From New York, yeah. I spent my early childhood in the Bronx, and Barbara and I lived in New York when we were first married. So
nice, and a different New York.
A very different New York.
Yeah. All right, Dan, you want to tell us your story?
Sure.
Thank you.
I'll start. We were leaving. Barbara and I were both in our 20s. We'd been married for only a couple of months. We'd left our jobs. We didn't know when we'd be back. We stood on the steel deck of a Greek freighter, watching a crew of longshoremen who had just finished loading cargo walk down the gangplank to a Brooklyn pier. Think on the waterfront or a view from the bridge. These guys could have been extras. We were almost ready to sail. The captain asked if we were going overseas to be missionaries. Us? Really? We said no. We liked the captain. We ate dinner with him. I played chess with him. A few days after we embarked, we found a jar of Greek honey in our cabin with a note, "Honey for your honeymoon," from the captain and crew. This wasn't the first time I'd taken a Greek freighter from Brooklyn. The first time I was only 13, I was traveling with my mother, who had just inherited a little money from her mother and decided to spend it on trips. Her younger brother, my Uncle David, was living in Rome. We'd stay with him and his wife, Barbara, a feisty Philadelphia Quaker who'd gotten an Ivy League law degree no later than about 1940. My uncle, a former college art teacher, was running the Italian mission of CARE, the international aid group that had started by delivering food in Europe after World War II. Years after the war, parts of Italy still needed help. Later on, as CARE expanded, Uncle David ran missions in a half dozen other countries on three continents. The ship carried a handful of passengers. One was a minor Greek shipping tycoon on his way home. Another was a Turkish guy in his late teens who was also on his way home. He'd been working illegally at his aunt and uncle's Brooklyn restaurant and had been deported. Then there was a middle-aged American woman traveling with family to Libya, where there was an American airbase, who lent me the hefty UFO yearbook for the previous year. After I encountered my mother out on deck one night with the Greek shipping tycoon, she explained to me that she and my father had a lousy marriage. I knew their relationship didn't generate a whole lot of affection or joy, but I had assumed all marriages were like that, weren't they? The Greek shipping tycoon wanted her to move to Greece and marry him. She wasn't interested. When we disembarked at Naples, climbing down a gangway to a small boat that ferried us ashore, he gave her a letter. We went to some obscure neighborhood where someone had told her of a man who was fluent in English and Greek as well as Italian. We found him in an elegant apartment concealed in an outwardly shabby building with someone selling a live octopus in the street below. The man was elderly. He read the letter. "It's a love letter," he told her. "Do you want me to translate?" She told him, "Don't bother." In Rome, we stayed in my aunt and uncle's apartment with high ceilings and marble floors. My uncle and I bet all the time. We bet on our chess games. We bet on whether or not the railroad crossing gate would be down when we drove to their rented summer place by the beach at Fregene. We paid each other off in bottles of aranciata. Although I hadn't known it, he and my mother hadn't liked each other very much. During the long evenings at the shore, they had a lot of time to talk. They discovered that, remember, these were very intelligent adults in their early 40s. They had resented each other for much of their lives because each had believed the other was their parents' favorite. Gotta love human nature. Once they got that out of the way, they liked each other just fine. For my 14th birthday, my mother said we could go anywhere I wanted. I wanted San Marino, the tiny republic totally surrounded by Italy near the Adriatic coast. Basically, it's a mountain with a little farmland around the base and a city with medieval battlements on top. We celebrated my birthday at an outdoor cafe, watching some guys practicing with crossbows, no doubt for the upcoming feast of San Marino's patron saint, and a celebration of the Republic's founding in the year 301, eating lasagna and drinking sparkling wine. It was a memorable birthday. I couldn't have visited Italy at a better time. Toward the end of the last school year, for a science paper, I had started reading about the origin of the universe, which of course raised questions. Was the universe eternal? If not, why had it started? And what had existed before the start? It blew my mind. And it got me thinking about time, deep time, and the passage of human generations. These are commonplace ideas, but they were news to me. Now I walk through the ruins of Pompeii. I saw Rome's standard tourist sites, the Forum, the Colosseum, the baths of Caracalla, where we saw the opera Aida, complete with elephants. And just walking around the city, I encountered marble fragments everywhere. It kept me thinking about time. As did the books I found on my aunt and uncle's shelves, books I probably wouldn't have picked up at home. I read Dante's Inferno, part of Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, Robert Graves' 1934 novel, I, Claudius. It all fit together. When we boarded that freighter, I hadn't realized my mother had plans beyond the summer. At some point, once we were in Italy, she told me she didn't want to go back. In fact, she didn't plan to go back. She'd applied for a job in Rome. If she got it, we'd stay there. I was ambivalent about that. On one hand, I loved being in Italy. On the other, everyone I knew was back in the United States. As it happened, she didn't get the job. At the end of the summer, we boarded a Danish freighter in Genoa and headed back to Brooklyn. I started high school a couple of weeks late, and I started it as a different person. Now, on this second voyage from the Brooklyn waterfront, I knew my life would change again. At least one thing would be familiar. I'd wind up with my Uncle David again, this time in Colombo, where he was running a care mission for Sri Lanka. We left the freighter in Piraeus, traveled to Sri Lanka through Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India. We spent more than a month in Kabul. Last month, explosions there killed people at a high school and a test prep educational center. The people killed were Shiite Muslims. The neighborhood was ethnically Hazara. I recalled Hazaras pulling heavy wooden carts built for horses or oxen through the city streets. And I recalled meeting an Afghan cardiologist at a Kabul dinner party. After dinner, when most guests had gone home, some people started criticizing the king. The king's government was less than ideal. No one expected the years of horror that would follow his ouster, and criticizing him was not considered a good idea. The cardiologist told the critics they should stop. After all, he quoted, the king is the shadow of God. Then he looked up to heaven and said, God, your shadow stinks. We don't need shadows. Send us light. The cardiologists and the critics were all Shiites. Even then, they felt marginalized. As we were leaving, our host, the cardiologist's cousin and a doctor himself, who'd been one of the critics, said, please, don't let anybody know. And then there was my uncle. He showed us his recent paintings patterned on gaudy Bollywood movie posters and took us to a Chinese restaurant where he, a lifelong vegetarian, loved the crab claws and ginger sauce. From his house, we walked at dusk to watch big fruit bats drop from banyan trees and fly away. We also swam in the Indian Ocean at a wonderful sandy beach, doing laps back and forth while my uncle floated on his back closer in. We were always the only Westerners on that beach, except for guys from the Soviet embassy. Other Europeans used a country club pool in the city. Under a full moon, we walked up Adams Peak on a trail we shared with earnest Boy Scouts, elderly religious pilgrims, some of whom died on the way up, and other young couples who wanted to reach the top in time to watch the sunrise. My uncle was a good host, although he gave me crap for working in the late morning instead of going downstairs to join everyone else for a drink before lunch. Naturally, we all had drinks before dinner, too. And when we arrived, as we passed through customs, the customs officer asked if we'd brought any gifts. No, we said. My uncle, waiting for us just across a low barrier, burst out, with outrage that was at least a touch real, no gifts? From Sri Lanka, we flew via Athens to Rome, where we went every day to admire the art in the Vatican Museum, and ate pasta afterwards, surrounded by regulars and the owner's well-fed kids in the back room of a family restaurant nearby. Next, we took a train to Paris, where we slept on our friend's Alan Randall's hardwood floor, joining them most nights to watch old cult American movies and eat cheap Vietnamese food. And then we came home to a country soon more troubled than the one we had left. When we watched those longshoremen leave our freighter, we didn't foresee much of what lay ahead. We didn't know what we were leaving behind. We'd been happy in Manhattan. We had great jobs. We had close friends. Every Sunday, after brunch with my father, we walked 10 miles across the Brooklyn Bridge and up through the city. Every weekend, when the weather was good, we met after work and walked home through the park. We had favorite shops all over the city for mozzarella, provolone, ricotta, bagels, brioche, rye. On Upper Broadway, a surly-looking butcher always gave us free meat. We felt New York was our town. Now we were sailing away. We didn't know we'd never really go back, but somehow I did know our lives would never be the same. I remember that realization as a disconcerting background to the city lights as we watched Manhattan vanish beyond our wake.
Volare, oh, cantare, oh, let's fly way up to the clouds, away from the maddening crowds. We can sing in the glow of a star that I know of, where lovers enjoy peace of mind. Let us leave the confusion and all disillusion behind. Just like birds of a feather, a rainbow together we'll find. Volare.
Thank you, Dan. That's a really beautiful story. So descriptive. Really, really. I mean, I was right there with you. It's so crazy how I've heard, just, you know, for so many years, the stories about, like, your aunt and uncle and your mother. And I feel like I would have partied hardy with your aunt and uncle in Sri Lanka or Rome or wherever, Mexico City. They sounded like just really amazing people. As did your mom, of course.
Yeah, a little quirky, to put it mildly, but yes.
Well, isn't that what life is about? Lots of good quirkiness. Your birthday that you threw in San Marino is so, it sounds just lovely. An evening I would like to be at.
It was. I mean, certainly for me at the time, it was pretty well perfect, I think, yeah.
What year was that?
God, what year was that? 1957.
Wow, that must have been crazy to be in Italy after World War II. I mean, so close after World War II.
Yeah, I was a kid, you know. I wasn't aware of, you know, the aftermath of the war, but certainly it was,
It was pretty poverty-stricken
at
that point.
It was pretty poverty-stricken. Mm-hmm. And you know, even this, you know, like all the scooters in Rome and stuff, yeah, that was very cool, but it was because people didn't have cars, right?
Yeah. No, well, you know, Torino, Fiat's far, it's a far cry from Rome.
Yeah.
What is Adam's Peak?
Adam's Peak is well, it's a mountain. It's not a very high mountain in Sri Lanka. It's not the highest. We climbed the highest, too. That's a different one more. Oh, God, I can't remember the geography very much. But Adam's Peak has this sort of large indentation at the top, and various religious groups think it's, you know, it's, I don't know, Muhammad's footprint or Adam's mm-hmm. footprint or, you know, the Buddha's footprint or whatever.
Got it, yeah. There's a there's a place in Ireland called Kirkpatrick that people believe that St. Patrick climbed. So all these very religious people climb it every year.
Yeah, I've actually read about that. I thought that would be a...
Adam and I went part of the way up, but we didn't go. Uh-huh. I notoriously wore the wrong shoes.
Not a good policy on a mountain.
Yeah. Not a good policy. It's usually not my MO to climb mountains, but, you know, I gave it the old try. Imagine what your life would have been like had your mom gotten that job.
Yeah, I sometimes think about that.
I bet you do. What was the job she was looking for?
I think it was for the UN Food and Agricultural Organization.
Did she work in New York?
Yeah.
She did.
She worked all her life until she was, I don't know, 50-something.
Yeah. Well, Dan, you want to get ready for our second story?
Sure.
Okay, awesome.
Sure.
Thank you.
And that it may be kind of a downer, but hey, I've been following the news from Ukraine, and, you know, what do you expect?
Oh, no. Yeah, there's a lot of news going on.
Yeah. Okay, here goes. It was barely spring. We'd just come home to the United States after traveling since early fall. The Vietnam War was going as badly as ever, but more people had finally acknowledged that it was a disaster. We spent a month in Manhattan, then headed out on what we knew would be a long roundabout journey to Seattle, where we'd met. We started by flying down to Tennessee. Dogwoods were blooming there, where I interviewed a physicist named Alvin Weinberg, who ran the Oak Ridge National Laboratory. I liked Weinberg. As a young man, he'd worked on the Manhattan Project, and later he'd become a big believer in nuclear power. He explained to me that in the 1950s, I think, he'd read a book by a descendant of Charles Darwin, who had argued that if we kept burning fossil fuels, the Earth was going to overheat. The author figured our choices were fission or fusion. Weinberg picked fission. He hoped building nuclear reactors instead of coal plants would be a way to prevent climate change. At the time, the argument about climate change made sense to me, but it seemed pretty obscure. What did I know? And why hadn't people who knew more than I did paid attention? From Tennessee, we flew north to visit my mother in Michigan. She had an apartment in Kalamazoo in a little house by a lake in nearby Pawpaw, which was and still is the center of Michigan's wine industry. I swam in the lake just about every day. There were still farms near Pawpaw, and it was spring, so we ate a lot of asparagus. My mother's old white rear-engine Corvair was parked under a tree outside. She'd bought it new and thought it was a wonderful car, even if Ralph Nader did say it was unsafe at any speed. She hadn't driven it in a long while. Neither had I, and I decided to take Barbara out for a ride. We drove down my mother's little side road to the main two-lane highway. As we approached the intersection, I pumped the brakes. Nothing happened. During the car's many months parked under the tree, the hydraulic fluid had leaked out. We didn't have any brakes. But there was no traffic at the moment, so I just accelerated out onto the highway. We drove until we found a place to U-turn and took the car very slowly back home. We coasted to a stop. That was the Corvair's last ride. It turned out to be the second scariest driving experience of our trip. We had the scariest in Wyoming. We took a train from Kalamazoo to Pocatello, my all-time favorite itinerary, then rented a car, a Camaro, for a trip to Idaho Falls, and finally drove down through Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks. We spent a night at the lodge in Grand Teton, then headed out through Jackson Hole back toward Pocatello. I was driving on the main two-lane road when a pickup truck with a camper top following a towing a boat pulled out ahead of us. The driver was going far below the speed limit, so I got the Camaro up to passing speed and was just about to pull into the left lane. When, without signaling, the guy in the truck turned left into a cafe's big gravel parking lot. His truck blocked the left lane. His boat blocked the right. I didn't have time to stop. There was plenty of space on the right, but there was also a drop-off, and if we'd gone that way, the car would have rolled. As I considered that, I visualized this boat in a Wyoming hospital. Not an attractive image. The only thing I could do was floor it and beat him into the center of the gravel lot, which I did. I turned sharply in front of him, skidded through a big wide U-turn, and when the tires caught again, drove back up onto the highway. We'd been very lucky. We took a bus to Salt Lake, borrowed a car from Barbara's sister, and drove down to central Utah to spend a few days with her grandparents. Every morning for breakfast, I ate pie that her grandmother had baked before we got up. When her grandfather, Marlin, actually Peter Marlin, but everyone called him by his middle name, found out I was almost 6 years younger than she was, he chided her for robbing the cradle. That became one of our standing jokes. Marlin and I got along just fine, not least because I valued his descriptions of how people lived there in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. He was 80 years old, a bit stooped, but still pretty tall. He had recently built sheds for the cattle at the dairy farm he'd passed along to a couple of his sons, and he was caring for a small herd of sheep. And he complained he wasn't good for much anymore. He figured he had ruined his health when, as a younger man, he had served as his community's watermaster, riding horseback along irrigation ditches for 48 hours at a stretch, making sure no one was taking more than his fair share of water. His kids liked seeing him come home from the irrigation ditches, his hat band stuffed with rattles from the snakes he had killed. Marlin had grown up there. As a boy in the late 19th century, he'd known some of the pioneers, whom he described in a later conversation with me as real wild men. As an adult, he'd raised six children without access to a doctor, which he told me he would never want to do again. If anyone offered him a chance to live his life over again, he said, he'd decline. And he remembered the way things used to be. Maybe it was on a later visit that Barbara, who'd spent much of her childhood in that valley, looked up at the mountains and said something about how barren they'd always been. No, her grandfather said, not always. He could remember when those slopes had been covered by waist-high grass, and you could see the grass ripple as herds of wild horses moved through it. Then people had started grazing sheep. Each spring, as the snow melted, they drove herds of sheep uphill right behind the melting snow. The sheep ate the green shoots as they came up. What the sheep didn't eat, they trampled into the mud. Over time, they created a desert. Marlin was not, I think, an environmentalist, but he knew what he'd seen. From Utah, we took a Greyhound bus on the last broken leg of our journey to Seattle. In the middle of the night, we stopped for a while in La Grande, Oregon. We walked. Out on the street, we could smell sage. The whole town smelled of sage. It was wonderful. The next day, we got off in the Tri-Cities, where we got a room at Richmond's Ballerina Motel. That night, on the Ballerina's TV, we watched coverage of California's Democratic presidential primary. I stayed until we knew that Robert Kennedy had won. Then I went off to take a shower. By the time I stepped out of the shower, Robert Kennedy had been killed. Jesus. Before long, we'd arrive in Seattle. Over the next couple of years, we'd spend 3 days at the original Sky River Rock Festival on the muddy outskirts of Monroe. Attend the Seattle City Council hearings about replacing the Pike Place Market with a big urban renewal project. Hang out at Frank's Landing by the Nisqually River with some of the people who were fishing in to assert tribal treaty fishing rights, which the courts hadn't yet recognized, and the state fought with everything it had. We saw a herd of Roosevelt elk from our camp above the rainforest. We learned to name the mock orange in our backyard, drove periodically to Vancouver to buy good coffee beans, at the Pioneer Square, to eat good French food at our friend Francois Cassel's Brasserie Pittsburgh. I recently flavored an omelet with sorrel I can trace back to seeds Francois brought back from a trip to France. And oh yes, before long we wound up with a couple of kids, and we moved to Vashon. But all that lay in the future. In the present, we had to deal with what we'd just seen. We landed at Kennedy Airport in March. Weeks later, Martin Luther King had been killed. We'd been in Manhattan when it happened. The previous spring, we joined the anti-war march King had led from Central Park to the United Nations. Now, on my way home, hours after he had died, I encountered a somber march from Times Square down to City Hall. I joined it. After about 15 blocks, some jerks up ahead, I couldn't see them, started breaking stuff. I heard plate glass windows shatter. I saw the mounted police who'd been following the marchers launch a cavalry charge right through the crowd. I think the horses managed to avoid trampling anyone. The cops didn't seem to care. What a way to honor King. I left. Now, 2 months later, Robert Kennedy was also dead. I was never a big fan of the Kennedys. I never figured America needed a royal family. But still, what was going on? This wasn't the country we'd left the year before. Or was it?
Well, come on, all of you big, strong men. Uncle Sam needs your help again. Got himself in a terrible jam way down yonder in Vietnam. Put down your books, pick up a gun. We're gonna have a whole lot of fun. And it's 1, 2, 3. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam. And it's 5, 6, 7. Open up the pearly gates. Well, there ain't no time to wonder why. Whoopee, we're all gonna die. Come on, generals, and let's move.
Thank you for sharing that story, Dan. Yeah, somber is a good way to put it, but it's real life. It's what happened.
It
you saw
life.
It, and it unfortunately, it's still happens today.
Yeah.
The same things, different people. It's just, will we ever learn?
Well, doesn't look promising, does it?
Yeah. No, it doesn't. It doesn't. Yeah, yeah. When I was in LA, I worked in film, and I worked on a bunch of different things that got shot in the hotel where Bobby Kennedy was shot at. I can't remember the name of it. I think it was like the Ambassador or something. It's right on Wilshire. Big, beautiful hotel. I think since then they may have turned it into a school, or they had talked about it, but I remember being in there and just feeling that. They were American royalty, if you want to call it that, for sure.
Yeah.
What a way to honor Martin Luther King.
Right.
Yeah.
All the way around, yeah.
Yeah, doesn't surprise me.
Well, no, it wasn't a surprise, I guess, but still.
I know. Dan, I really want to thank you for coming on. That was a really poignant story for what's going on in the world today. So thank you for that.
You're welcome.
And this is Megan Hastings, and this is the Cats and Jammer Follies.
I've been everywhere.